Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back for another podcast considering Season 1, Episode 4, King of the Narrow Sea. This time the feedback version, where we hear what everybody out there listening to our show has to say. Aaron, did anybody care to chime in this week?
They did, including our merch manager, Tulip Blossom, from the Bald Move community. She runs a graphics t-shirt type of store and wanted to know if we wanted some help earlier this year on our merch, because we have essentially abandoned it ever since Cecily left the company. It's just kind of in Flying Dutchman ghost mode. She has got a lot of really cool Hot D merchandise. If you want to check that out, go to merch.baldmove.com, head down to the Game of Thrones section. Probably need to update the name of that, but she has got our snazzy cover art on mugs, posters, really cool posters. Got one, a 20-inch one here in the studio. And also they photoshopped the background out of the out of our show art to put us on T-shirts and stuff, too, if you want really badass podcasters cosplaying as Renfair characters. It's all at merch.baldmove.com. So check that out. And thanks for working hard on that for us, Deb. Let's get right to the rest of the feedback. It's hotd@baldmove.com is how you contribute to this year's podcast. And oh my goodness, we get so much of it. Daniel J says, I really love this week's episode. I feel like the show has found its voice and I love the ways in which it's decidedly not Game of Thrones. So far, there's been no cartoonishly evil characters like Joffrey or Ramsay, no White Walkers, just real people with complex motivations and flaws. Even politically ambitious players like Otto are grounded in decency. Crabfeeder might have been a real piece of shit, but we didn't get to know him.
Yeah.
Didn't look like he had a lot of redeeming, you know. I don't even know if he could take that mask off. It might have fused to his barnacle face. Who knows?
Yeah, and Damon is not a cartoon character. He's petty, he's impetulant, he's a child, he's all those things, but he's not a cartoon.
Nah, if he was and Rhaenyra walked into that Silka street joint, he would have gone awooga and his face would have turned into a wolf and his tongue had rolled out. So that's right away how you can tell he's not a cartoon character. Viserys is most emblematic of the show's tone, Daniel opines. He's flawed but sweet, passionate but tortured. House of Dragon is less an adrenalized version of Game of Thrones and it suits me better. Which is wild because from the first episode, I kind of thought we might have a show trying to out Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. And this was a lot of sex, but it's someone pointed out, I think it was on the House of R, Joanna and Mallory show, where they said it was the difference about this sexual depictions in this show and in some, especially early goings of Game of Thrones, where they would use, you know, women having sex is kind of like, it's like people would be talking and then in the background people just be swinging from trapeze and, you know, doing all this performative sex. Where like in these back rooms of brothels, like people were fucking, you know, like people were touching people. It was just kind of like a heaving, writhing mass. It wasn't for viewer. I don't know. I feel like I'm doing a bad job of saying it wasn't intended for like one particular person's pleasure or the other, or it wasn't voyeuristic for one person or another. It's kind of like more pan in its appeal. So
okay, it's also for the characters more than the audience, which I appreciated.
That's exactly what I was trying to say about the voyeurism. It wasn't, you know, like it wasn't intentionally, it was there to titillate the characters, sure, and for them to participate in, and we happened, but like the other stuff felt like it's more for like, man, this is some boring dialogue. Let's throw some ass and titties in there.
Yeah.
Shake them around so the people pay attention. I also like the way the past two episodes have had more of a Renaissance feel to the clothing, art depiction, and direction of the customs of the realm. Game of Thrones often avoided this kind of visual iconography. Some viewers have called out the fact that House of Dragon is happening almost two centuries before Game of Thrones, but there's been no noticeable cultural or technical logical difference between the two eras. I think Tahati's use of Renaissance iconography does some work in differentiating the two time periods, making Hathi seem more antique than Game of Thrones. I know that's one of George's desires. He wanted it to be, because if you look at a lot of his covers before the show started releasing, like, man, it's really Renfesty in the blousing and the coloration and the plumage of feathers and all festooning hats and stuff. It's a lot more Henry VIII than you would think just if you watched the show. Yeah. And yeah, like this really colorful heraldry and, you know, mismatching of themes and colors and shapes and stuff. I think it's cool, too. I was wondering if you noticed the overt use of wind sounds in this week's episode. I thought it was pretty heavy handed. I was wondering what the show creators were saying with this. Are we to understand that the winds of winter are blowing? Did you notice?
Wind. So,
I'll say that I did notice when they were in Storm's End, the Baratheon castle, doing the Bachelorette episode. There was a lot of wind, but canonically, that's a windy as fuck place. Like, the reason this is called Storm's End is because they built five castles on that spot that the sea blew down. And then they got, I think, an assist from Brandon the Builder, the guy who built Winterfell on the Wall. And he came down and was like, fuck it, I got this. And that's when Storm's End was created. But it's still right there on the coast of the Narrow Sea, battered by those westerly winds. I didn't notice any other. So, but I thought that was appropriately cinematic. Maybe there is some subtle winds blowing.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know. It seems a little too early for that in the history, but they're going into the prophecy stuff, so who knows?
We got a ton of feedback on this because we are flatulence central, high command of flatulence. Oscar from Puerto Rico says, did you guys not hear the super fart Viserys let loose during this episode? Speaking of windy, it happened after Alicent asked if Daemon wanted to see the tapestries. Viserys mockingly asked Daemon if he'd want to see the tapestries, and he burst into laughter while letting the nastiest fart go. I watched it on the HBO Max app and rewound it four or five times to make sure I heard what I thought I heard. So it's funny because I compiled about half the feedback last night, and then I went for a late afternoon paddleboard session before the sunset. And like you do, I was listening to Game of Thrones podcasts, and some of them drop visual sound, you know, they'd actually drop a dialogue when they're introducing scenes. And I was thinking about this, like, God, everyone's talking about this goddamn fart. And someone played this where I think what's happening is Viserys goes, tapestries? No one wants to see your damn tapestries, girl. He's like blowing raspberries, but it kind of cuts away from his mouth. And it sounds like a fart because he's going like, so, yeah.
Are these the winds of winter that the previous?
That's what I'm talking about? The brown winds of winter. Yeah. I don't think so. I think this was a onomatopoeia type of fart situation, not a beefy bean burrito type of fart. But you watched it four or five times. I just listened to it paddling a paddleboard. Alex from England says, I've been listening to you both for such a long time. I've never emailed, but felt compelled by following your chat on the previous episode for episode 2 about how technology between Hathi and Game of Thrones has barely changed, something that Daniel just talked about, too. I'm sure there is no fact around this, as everything beyond Dance with Dragons is essentially Double D fanfic until Martin gets done with Winter and Spring. But do we think the Planetos in the future gets its own industrial revolution? Is electricity possible? Does magic trump all this and keep the universe in a medieval style state? I don't know if there's answers to these questions or if they're even interesting, but I'd like to see a 500 years later Westeros and how the different house exists, how the stories of dragons are told, etc. Am I insane?
Just go watch Succession. I think that's it.
Is so perfect with the bridge to the next email.
That would be interesting, I think, to see what an industrial revolution both would look like and do to this world. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. Like, does the magic of Westeros, the weird seasons and stuff, extend elsewhere into its physicality?
Dude, I could be so on board with, like, 10 years from now, if they really get Game of Thrones established as an IP, like Star Trek or Star Wars or, you know, Marvel, DC, that kind of stuff, I would love to see a steampunk hot D.
Oh, yeah.
I do think you have a point, because I've observed that mankind will often eschew technological advancements if the old way is still profitable and more convenient. See petroleum products. Mm-hmm. And I think if you have a crutch like magic and dragons and things, that would be a pretty good resistor to technologic change. Like, you know, why do you need to invent aircraft and bomb and all that kind of stuff? But so, like, you know, how would that society have grown if you've got that kind of like an anchor? Maybe magic goes away after the long night. Part two. I would love to see Game of Thrones with, like, maybe King's Landing is still there and exists. It's been rebuilt, but it's got like dirigibles. It's got airships.
Or, yeah, dragons pulling, like, sleds, like a reindeer, like Santa's deer.
Yeah, yeah. I could definitely see a, you know, a equivalent 17th, 18th century steampunk hot D for sure. That would be fucking sweet.
I don't know. This all sounds like Martin Heresy stuff. I don't know that he would allow this.
Well, that's why I said 10 years. Probably Martin would have to die. Does he have an estate? He doesn't have kids. Like, what happens to the Martin? I don't think. Maybe he does. He has a wife. I wonder what happens if, I don't have no idea. He dies. I think it reverts to her. If she dies, then what?
I don't know.
They follow the line of male progenitor or whatever. So they go back to his brother and his eldest child. I don't know. Double T says Succession with Dragons was a tagline thrown around to describe the plot machinations of this show. Okay. Now, I'm seeing a deeper comparison. Like Succession, this show is really a show about a bunch of privileged assholes being assholes to each other. Unlike Succession, I'm enjoying Hot D, but if I'm being honest, it's only because I'm such a fan of the world of Game of Thrones. I find it infinitely more entertaining than the corporate bullshit of Succession, which hits too close to home with its miserable cynicism. That doesn't change the fact to me that this is a show filled with unlikable characters. The story intrigues me, but I couldn't give a direwolf's ass who wins in the end. I'm not invested in anyone, and I compare this to the likability and charisma of characters in the first seasons of Game of Thrones with Ned, Jon Snow, Arya, Bran, Tyrion, Sam, even roguish characters like Jaime and Bronn you could sort of get behind. Problem is, Targaryens seem to be all Lannisters with dragons, a bunch of arrogant pricks. I know you guys also have problems with Succession. Are you seeing some of the same issues here?
Not entirely. I mean, I think there are a bunch of assholes who I don't like, but also I'm really liking some characters like Rhaenyra and Viserys and Lord Strong. I think those are like the standouts so far for me as far as likability goes. So I don't think everybody's an asshole.
I think Rhaenyra is turning out pretty unlikable, though.
I mean, the more I see, the more I'm like, this episode is the first time I've actually disliked her in a scene.
Okay.
But up till this point, she's been all good with me.
And, you know, sometimes, you know, character arcs are arcs when people grow. And I don't know how much growth Jon Snow actually did. He started off as a very good, principled guy. And he ended as a very good principled guy. It was tested. I mean, he was tested. He had all these different tests of his bravery, of his courage, of his kindness, of his. But, like, you know, he passed every single one of them. It might be more interesting to turn someone like, you know, a bratty, privileged, entitled person like Rhaenyra and see if she could become a capable ruler. Can someone as, like, pragmatic and tradition oriented in terms of the gender roles and stuff as Alicent, would she be a better queen, or can she find a middle path between kind of where she started and, you know, can she become less of a Sansa, you know? Mm-hmm. I see your point. I think that the shows are in different points of time. Like, we haven't even gotten to what I would call the inciting event. Whereas the inciting event of Game of Thrones with Jon Arryn's death, that's like the shit was starting to happen and starting to roll. Yeah. And you saw these people thrust into the limelight, like three quarters of the cast of characters hasn't even been introduced. You know, I'm not going to say like three quarters of the most important people haven't been induced, but like there's a lot of stuff to come. And it's a balancing act between, like, I think we're paying the price for a deeper understanding of the setting and how things got there by the price we pay there is for thinner characters.
Gotcha.
You know. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur: Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now, back to Hot D. Brandon from Louisville says, aren't there other Targs living in Westeros at this time? Surely there's more than just the four that we have seen on the show. Who are they and where do they live? This is the type of question I just can't answer. I'm sorry. I could read the Wikipedia article, the Wiki of Ice and Fire, that will tell you who all the Targaryens are and what they're living and what they're doing and what do they do when their banners are called and whose banner they heed. But, you know, that's what we call spoilers. So I these are type of questions. I could tell you the dragons and their names and their colors and all that, but don't you just kind of want to see them shriek on a screen?
Mm-hmm.
Andy from LA says, hey guys, I'm enjoying your coverage of House of the Dragon on Patreon. Well, thank you for your support. I noticed that everyone's having fun with the Hot D acronym. However, the official title of the show is Game of Thrones : Hot House of the Dragon, which makes the acronym Got Hot D.
Got Hot D.
Got: Hot D.
It's a t-shirt.
Makes it even nastier, I think. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you could just run that back like the old Got Milk commercials, right?
Mm-hmm.
Got Hot D.
Have that Hot D dripping down somebody's top lip.
Plus, people are not watching Hot D to think you're just really full of yourself. Or maybe you're just asking. Yeah. You're just asking, who's got it?
Sure.
I want it.
I mean, that was the milk thing. Yeah, there's a question mark at the end.
Yeah, you got milk because I want your milk. Because I, you know what? I always interpret it as like, you got milk because I do. I got my milk. You should get your milk. But you're saying that was a questing question. Yeah, who's got some, milk? Do you got
I'm
milk?
I'm looking for milk. Do you got
give me give me your fucking milk. I need. Yeah, okay. Wow.
Yeah, that's how I always interpreted that.
I came at it from the opposite end. So like, yeah, this that would make you seem like you're thirsty for hot D. I was thinking of saying you possess it and you're like asking anyone else if they do as well. Either way,
works. Yeah.
Banger t-shirt. We'll see what Deb thinks of that. Lisbeth says, on my second watch of episode 3 and after discussion about whether Damon is impotent or if he just was frustrated during his encounter with Rhaenyra, I started putting a few things together. Not only did he seem unable to perform in episode 1 with his mistress, but when speaking to Rhaenyra in that garden area where they're speaking in High Valyrian, she mentions that basically his wife is lucky because he hasn't put a baby in her. Mm-hmm. Is this because he never sees her? Or is it because he's impotent? I wonder if this leads to more later on. It seems like a lot of instances at this point pointing towards either he cannot perform, and if so, why would that be a thing? I'm curious.
What good is an heir who can't produce heirs?
Not very good.
I mean, that draws into question, like, why should I make you the heir at all if you're unable to produce heirs beyond yourself? Come on, Damon.
Yeah, and it could be for this role. The gentleman doth protest too much about the whole bronze bitch stuff, because I think canonically Lady Royce is supposed to be beautiful. So is he just dogging her and so that no one asks him, like, how come you haven't gotten a child out of her yet, Damon? You know, and every time we've actually seen him having sex, he's never gotten there.
Yeah.
Sometimes he's not even started. Lots of different ways to be impotent. Lots of different causes, too.
Definitely something to that.
Renly Baratheon was somewhat impotent, but only with Margaery. I'm not saying that Damon is, thinking that way. I'm just saying there's lots of ways you can be impotent that might not be like a permanent medical condition. Leon from Portsmouth, UK, says, regarding Damon being covered in crab feeder's blood, would Damon be aware of the risk of grayscale? The maesters didn't mention grayscale as a possible infection when examining Viserys, and I'm wondering if grayscale was a known condition in the time period of Hot D. Oh, yeah. You know King Jaehaerys, Jim? Old King Jaehaerys. This would be Viserys's grandfather. Well, he had a daughter, Maegle, who was became a septa and dedicated her life to healing, and she specialized in helping children with grayscale. And tragically, she caught grayscale and died of it. Just real poke in the eye for, number one, anyone saying that Targaryens can't get disease. And two, if you think that the maesters don't know about grayscale. I think that what it is we know about grayscale, and it's kind of like the only pox we really are familiar with if we're showrunners. So like when we see a skin lesion, like, oh shit, that's grayscale. This is like the lupus of House.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to me like Viserys is manifesting grayscale. That's not reading as grayscale to me. That's reading as some sort of
pussy wound
disease.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is definitely known. I mean, obviously this stuff is outside of the universe canon. But like, yeah, grayscale is certainly known by this time. And I just think it's not. I just think it's not grayscale. Sarah says, though, did you happen to see the scaly spots in Damon's neck and chest? Maybe I was looking for it, but I swear I saw them. Very pale, scaly spots, but I could have sworn they're there. Maybe they didn't drop the grayscale ball.
There's definitely some kind of like, it's either scarring or, yeah, something irregular about the skin there, for sure.
So in last episode, they showed Damon taking a fire arrow to the upper chest area. Mm-hmm. And the flames are kind of like bathing over his neck and chest. And in subsequent scenes of the episode, that is very red and inflamed. And I think they're suggesting that these are stepstone war wounds, that he got burnt by these arrows. And which, again, Targaryen fireproofness. Where am I right?
Right.
And when I did some pausing on my 4K copy and getting real close to the television and using my bifocals and squinting, and it looks like burn tissue to me.
Yeah, makes sense.
Marshall from Tampa, Florida says, I'm a former Navy Corps captain here, an Afghanistan veteran with firsthand experience in naval and army traditions. Marines are great because they kind of go both ways. They're in with the Navy, but they also are pounding the ground. Superior female commissioned officers are directly referred to as ma'am. When given an order, the response to the Navy and the Marines is, "I, ma'am." And when answering a yes or no question, the answer is yes or no, ma'am. There's no current tradition, official or unofficial, that superior female officers be referred to as sir. There could be some historic examples of this from other militaries, but I've never seen this in real life, nor would there be any tolerance for it in practice. I have direct experience with this because during officer candidate school, I accidentally referred said I, sir, to a female officer because I've been saying sir a lot and that muscle memory built up. And the female officer rightly lit me the fuck up. Would never make that mistake again, which is a good thing because I primarily worked for more senior female Marine Corps officers during my service. There's zero tradition of referring to women as sir or gentleman, even in a mixed group. My hunch is this is a purely Hollywood invention out of misplaced attempt at representing our military customs and traditions. I cringe every time I see this on Star Trek and other sci-fi series that have practices loosely based on naval traditions. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I feel like we talked about this already, did we not?
I think we asked, and now we got, these are the answers, the definitive answers on it.
Because I thought I remembered talking about how I've been lied to by every single...
I think we wondered if we'd been lied to, because we got a couple. This was just happened to be the first service member to respond, but gotcha. We got the only branch that didn't report in: Coast Guard, Space Force, and Air Force. We heard from the Army, Navy, and Marines. Barrett says, when you were giving your mea culpa, not knowing about the they-them of one of the hot D-casts, I realized two things. One, I was woefully unaware that we've mostly just been watching Millie Alcock play young Rhaenyra and not Emma D'Arcy. Alcock uses she, her pronouns, and D'Arcy uses they, them. Two, it got me thinking about whether they are setting the groundwork for one or both of Rhaenyra and Allison to be a lesbian, bisexual, or have an otherwise queer relationship. We first meet young Rhaenyra, played by Millie Alcock. She comments to Allison that her dragon may soon be large enough for two people to ride. It's extremely subtle, but it had a bit of a romantic ride together with Alicent. Later in episode one, we see Rhaenyra laying in Alicent's lap, discussing their potential future across the narrow sea. The other piece that caught my eye is Alicent has a nervous anxiety tic of biting her fingernails when faced with the prospect of romancing the king. It's easy to assume it's because of the age gap, but it also makes sense if it's actually a gender aversion to the male king. There could be a lot of reasons why, but the show's hinting at Allison being some form of not entirely straight. I think they're setting up Rhaenyra has at least some leanings toward the male gender. Maybe Allison's love of Rhaenyra is unrequited. Maybe they're bringing in Emma D'Arcy to portray an LGBTQ character in greater depth later.
It's possible.
I saw some behind... So I think one of these young ladies is gay. I can't remember which one, but I remember this being part of the preseason stuff and that they'd gotten together and they had decided that there was a little bit of like, maybe it was experimental. Maybe it was actually like the buddings of young gay love between Alicent and Rhaenyra. And I definitely think that came across. So that's a valid interpretation of those scenes. And it would be super interesting because it's not like, cause like this is a part of Martin's world. The way being gay conflicts in his culture in the various different, because like, you know, there's the whole air of it. There's the whole forced marriage aspect of it. There's the hyper masculinity and patriarchy of it. Mm-hmm. And even in this era, there's definitely characters in the books that are discussed about being gay or sometimes openly gay that will figure into the plot unless they erase them from the thing. And I don't think they're going to do that. Yeah. So it's like everything you're picking up is being put out there. There's a lot of other interpretations, like, and you know, Hollywood tends to like to play pussyfoot with this stuff more than just tackle it straight on, especially with like your mainline protagonists. Don't know. That would definitely complicate things. You know, like I said, the whole forced marriage aspect of it would be really tragic in that case.
Yeah, this series is no stranger to that. I mean, they did it in Game of Thrones, so.
Yeah, you had Renly and Sir Lawrence, and even Cersei in the books fucked around with some lesbian dalliances. Hannah says, I was immediately suspicious about the moon tea that was delivered to Princess Rhaenyra. The maester said it was from the king, but I don't believe him. I think the king is too timid of a father to send his daughter Plan T. I love the way everybody's referring to the moon tea as Plan T. Uh-huh. I think he would rather believe that his daughter was innocent, as she claimed to be to Alicent. I think the tea was sent by someone on the council, perhaps Otto, but maybe even Daddy Strong. If she drinks it, it could be evidence of her loss of virtue and cause Alicent to feel betrayed, according to her opposition to Rhaenyra's claim. Boy, was this a hot email in my feedback box. There's variations of it, but everyone wants to know is like, are we sure Viserys ordered this tea to be drank? B, who might it be if not? And C, is it a loyalty test? Because if Rhaenyra drinks it, she's confessing that she needs it. If she doesn't drink it, I don't.
This is one bold maester. If this is not an order from the king, this is a bold fucking maester, man. Like, come in here and tell the heir to be that the king has ordered you to drink this tea.
I mean, we've seen some pretty bold maesters.
that's sort of beyond the pale. I can't even imagine
what do you think about Otto would be as a parting gift.
I mean, it all comes down to this maester. That's like the point of contact here is the maester. The person who's saying it came from the king is the maester. So
he has
guy
to be complicit.
Who would have to be.
So if it's anybody's idea than him, it's a conspiracy. De facto a conspiracy.
I mean, if you want to say Otto, sure, Otto, like, as you know, the previous hand of the king has now conspired to do what, though? To do what?
Well, what are we saying? That Otto is going to come in. He's just been dismissed by the king. Uh-huh. He's going to come in. And it's like, sire, as I was cleaning out my desk, I got word that your daughter, in fact, guzzled the moon tea that I had secretly prepared for her, thus proving that she is a fornicator. aren't I not back in your good graces, my liege? Like, fuck no, that's not gonna, like, he might get ran through. He might get ran through. He might get Dracarys'd. Like, I don't, it's like, that's the thing, it's like, to what end? Like, now, so let's ask. So I think you and I are both skeptical of anybody but the king. Does Viserys, as a test, have the maester brew this and then has the ladies in wait report to him whether it's drank the next morning?
Possibly. I mean, I can see that. To me, like, what this is saying is he doesn't fully trust her. That's what they're actually trying to indicate here. I don't think there's some grand conspiracy.
I don't think.
This is a loyalty test. I really think it's just saying Viserys doesn't believe her.
And you know what? If I'm an 18-year-old teenage punk that just had secret sex and my mom or dad comes in here and says, drink this fucking tea, you sleut. Mm-hmm. I'm probably like, I'm 50-50. Like, well, you know what? Maybe I should drink this. Like, if I want to get right with my dad's like, you know what? I know what I did, but if this makes them feel better, I'll drink the tea. And then I'm going to be I mean, I guess in this case, I'm feel fucking guilty as sin either way. Yeah, I don't know.
Either way, it's a confession. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'd probably not drink it out of spite. I'd be like, I'm going to carry this love baby to full term. And I got a baseborn like git, dad. What are you going to do about it? Lord. Jake from Cali says, hey, guys, quick question. If King Viserys' whole point when questioning Otto initially over his accusation was she sullied? Couldn't Viserys have one of his maesters do the hymen examination of his daughter a la rapper T.I.? Holy shit, that's a deep cut. And see for sure if Daemon or anyone thus far has pierced the veil, so to say. Wouldn't it clear a lot of confusion around Daemon, but it also could force Rhaenyra to say who actually did it, Sir Crispin Cole. Well, I'm honor bound here to point out that an intact hymen is not the be all end all evidence for virginity. It can mean anything from the lady rode a horse too hard to the lady experimented with a hairbrush to the lady maybe didn't have a fully formed hymen in the first place.
I was going to say,
So let's just get just before the medieval lawyers come out to inform. I get it that this is. A bullshit test of purity, which is in itself a bullshit concept. Having said that, we know from Game of Thrones that that was one of the things that like the Maesters did with Sansa before they inspected her to make sure she was still intact. Okay. So this is a thing that this society believes in as a foolproof litmus test of, and I suppose if you have a completely intact hymen, it does say that you haven't had anything in your vagina.
Sure. That's odds are pretty good.
Too deep, I guess. Like it says nothing about the poop hole loophole. Says nothing about the Bill Clinton oral sex exemption, the many ways that people can make love to each other, but there's no PNV, probably. Asterisk, asterisk. What do you think? What do you think about the king
testing his daughter's way? I mean, if he wants to make a federal case out of it, sure. If it turns out she doesn't drink the moon tea and he really wants to know, sure, why not? I guess
sure
they could go that route, but... boy, that seems extreme.
I'm getting an update from the Ball Booth news deck from our producer that it's Emily Carey, who plays young Allison, who has identified as queer. So I would have swore it was the opposite. So that's why I was like, you know what?
Yeah,
I literally wouldn't take a bullet over this knowledge. I'm just going to say one of them, because I was sure that one of them did. And turns out it was Allison. Let's move on to Maggie, who says, I know the standard obvious take on Allison's reaction to Rhaenyra and Daemon hooking up is that she's horrified, but her true feelings inside may be jealousy. She's stuck with a husband who's falling apart and just pumping out babies, where Rhaenyra still has her pick of the hot dudes of the kingdom. Recall Daemon asking for Allison's favor during the joust in episode 1. She seemed pretty flattered, and her strong feelings of distaste regarding Daemon seem like how one acts when they're hot for someone, but trying not to show it by acting disgusted instead. Would love to know what you guys think.
I mean, it's not quite explicit in the episode, but it is there saying that she's at least jealous of her lifestyle, of the freedom that she has compared to what Allison is experiencing at the moment. So sure, I could see jealousy from that angle. As far as like specifically for Daemon, I mean, I don't know. It was her obligation and her duty in that moment to give him favor. Did she seem overly like excited about it? I can't quite remember.
That was my interpretation of that scene, that she has to do it because he's the prince, and she looks at her, but like, and she gives a look to her father, and her father's dying inside because, you know, obviously. But also, she's a 14-year-old girl, and this is like one of the... he's not even eligible. He's an eligible bastard. Almost said he's an ineligible bastard in the realm. He's like this. He's the prince, and he's a badass warrior, and he's in his fancy dragon stuff, and he's saying, "I want your favor, my lady." As a 14-year-old, oh my god, yeah. I think she was a little. She even if she was leaning towards the ladies, like, I still think you're capable of being flattered, you know, right?
Oh, sure.
I've been hit on by men, and I was always like, oh god, I didn't know I could pull it. You know, it happens, right?
Yeah.
Alex says, in the main Game of Thrones show, we don't learn much about Varys' background. The Master of Whispers role seems to be a family business. What are the chances that the little boy is either a father or grandfather of Varys, or that Mysyria is Varys' grandmother or mother, whether by blood or marriage? Do we believe Mysyria when she says she can't have children?
Trying to remember exactly how she phrased it.
She said
she saw to it that she would not have children.
She took steps to ensure she would not be afflicted with children. And to me, that sounds like some modification of plumbing. Magical, surgical.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Super moon tea.
Sure, I believe her in that. But I also think that seems like some Disney small world shit. I don't know, especially with the origins of Varys. That's like, the odds are astronomical.
Yeah, do we want this to be too much like Star Wars, where like Yoda comes out of nowhere and is like, old drinking buddies, me and Chewbacca were. It's like, what?
Yeah.
What? Darth Vader put together C-3PO for his slate? What? You know, like, sometimes, like, it makes, you're right, a very, very small world.
Yeah. Too just so. And I don't really like that. I like things a little bit messier.
I definitely think that the use of children as informants is a spiritual, you know, ancestor to Varys's little birds, right? So, like, mm-hmm. if there's not a genetic connection, there's certainly a spycraft connection.
Which and is it could neat. Just be a cultural connection, right? Because they are from the same area of the world. So it could just be that, like, children are viewed differently over there.
Did we talk about this in the main podcast? The fact that, like, was this a feedback that, like, some... Because I thought this was a good point that, you know, Varys and Missary are both people who were used as children. Mm-hmm. And that they might not see the use of children in the exact same way that those of us that had, like, upbringings where we were legally protected, you know, like sure. sometimes that abuse and rolls downhill. Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting point to keep in mind. Emily says Viserys taking out his anger and frustration on a poor Otto and eventually firing him is reminiscent of Daemon beating the messenger last episode. I wouldn't advise telling any Targaryen any bad news going forward. This is interesting. Because one of the many drawbacks to being an evil overlord or just like a peevish, dickish leader is you eventually are surrounded by yes men because you drive away, mm-hmm. execute, or fire the rest. And then you cease getting accurate information about the world. And then you're fucked. Then you're
yeah.
fucked.
Yeah. Oh boy, so, I view those two things as very different. But yes, I think it's a dangerous thing to tell powerful people news they don't want to hear. Especially yeah. if they're as impetuous as Daemon.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Like beating someone half to death is different than sacking them for cause.
Well, and that's
but it's the for right? cause. It's like yes. how much do you but the thing is like I feel like the show told us that maybe not to the extent that Viserys thinks, but the Otto is compromised. Mm-hmm. He's compromised by the pressure his brother puts on him. He's compromised by the fact that his daughter's on the throne and his blood is now in line to it's like, yeah, that's the problem I have with this analysis anyway. Patrick says, is this show being told officially from the narrative point of view of Rhaenyra? In the first episodes, the older version of her is narrating the choosing of a new king. I know you mentioned the book has multiple narrators, but I find it interesting that they use a character that gives the future demise of the Targaryens and how they ultimately cease to exist. Are we to think that this is her telling a story to someone? Man, there's two types of voiceovers. There's like the Henry Hill voiceover in Goodfellas. All my life, I wanted to be a gangster. And he shows up throughout this, and it's clearly his point of view, his life story. Mm-hmm. And then there's like Galadriel in the prologue of Lord of the Rings, where she's just like a point of view character giving the omniscient narration of what happened. Or I guess it could be her point of view of the prologue, but it's certainly not her point of view story. If anyone, it's Sam's point of view. Mm. So like, you can go in both artistic directions and both are perfectly valid and successful. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing this is going to be more of the Galadriel type.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I don't see this all coming back to like a scene at the very end where Rhaenyra is sitting with Alicent or something and talking about, oh, remember all those experiences right. we went through.
Remember that dance we had with dragons? Wasn't that crazy?
Right.
Yeah, and like I also like there's things that are happening that there's no way that Rhaenyra would know. But I guess that happens in Goodfellas too, but like Henry always explains through the narration that like, you know, he knew about this because blah blah blah. I don't know. I doubt it. But it'll be interesting to see if there's evidence pointing towards this POV theory to go forward. Patrick also says, was the secret tunnel from the episode the one that Tyrion uses to escape King's Landing and Jaime used to have Cersei meet Tyrion in the final season? It's important. Well, I don't know how important it is. It is accurate from a lore perspective to understand that this is not a tunnel. This is a series, a maze-like web of tunnels that shoot through the Red Keep, allowing people to go from one room to the next and from inside and outside the castle without detection. So it wouldn't be surprised if they reused the sets a lot just because, you know, and obviously, you know, there was the big skull of... that's the other thing is like, huh, I thought that skull, that tunnel, the skull of Balerion the Black Dread is not part of the tunnel. Do you think so?
I can't keep track of the skull because wasn't it in like the crypts or whatever?
It was, and it still is. It was still surrounded by. So I'm guessing she took a tunnel that connected to there and then another tunnel because like.
I think so.
I don't think those are Maegor's secret tunnels. And in the Game of Thrones series, like Robert hated the Targaryens and he had all the official displays of the Targaryens, the bones and whatnot, stricken to like the underlayers of King's Landing where you could conceivably come across them. But no, there's a bunch of different tunnels. I don't think there's just a tunnel that goes from a point A to point B. It's just there. It's just crisscross and confusing and you can get lost easily, et cetera.
To jump back to that previous email for a second, wasn't that like one of the popular running theories in Game of Thrones where it was going to be Sam writing some book,
like the official history? Yeah, keeping the official history
book we were going to write, but yeah, it was going to be Sam writing the Song of Ice and Fire. Yeah, I'm kind of glad they didn't do that. Although, who knows? It might have been a better ending than what they did come up with.
And who would write a better story for the end of Game of Thrones but Sam the Storyteller?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly wasn't David and Dan, those bastards. Let's move on to Josh. The biggest question I had, and I'm surprised that neither of you mentioned on a Tuesday, is why didn't Rhaenyra just go back to her room the way she came? Tunnel talk. Then she just calls bullshit on Otto and used Sir Christian as her alibi. She could still seduce him if she wanted to, but he could truthfully say she never left her room. I know the simple answer is Rhaenyra's naivete in politics, but still.
Yeah. I mean, I think she's intentionally trying to get his attention here, right? Like this is a thing to make him notice her and then pull him into the room.
Yeah. I'm super bad at directions. So like, if you give me if Google Maps takes me someplace that's like 15 minutes away, and then you destroyed my phone, I would be lost.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to call my wife and be like, "Can someone pick me up? I have no idea how to get home." Because I wonder like if Rhaenyra's got the same thing. She's following this map. It's dark. It's twisty. It's dark. Like, do you pay attention to all the landmarks from the secret tunnel that you emerged from? I got it to like when Daemon left her, she. I don't know if she still had the map, and I don't know like if she just one time through, it's just super easy. Now, do you buy that like as an in-universe explanation for someone not taking what seems to be the obvious? Like if you sneak out of your house through the back window, for example, you never come back in through the front door.
You're talking about if you're a teenager sneaking out from your parents' house. Okay.
Yes.
Why would I be sneaking out from my own house?
Sorry,
and
I thought that was all clear.
Why wouldn't I come in the front door? No. Okay.
Yeah. Remember when you're like 17 and you're sneaking out and you're not letting your. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But I'm pretty familiar with the backyard of my home. I'm less familiar with the secret tunnel that I've just opened up for the first time and didn't know was there and all the ins and outs of that.
And your home's not a giant castle that's like a complex unto its own. I mean, yeah, I didn't think it was that big a deal. I didn't think it was I don't think it's just because she's naive. I mean, I think she knew that there was consequences to being discovered. And she also probably trusted Sir Christian is not going to rat her out even before she decided to seduce him. Nah, I was going to say, because I think the natural question people might ask is that why she seduced him? You know, to kind of like make him complicit of her being a bad girl. But like, I don't think she's thinking like that.
Mm-hmm.
Joe says, one thing that stood out to me in the conversation between Rhaenyra and Alicent in the Godswood was Rhaenyra swore on the memory of her mother that nothing happened between her and Daemon. And while they didn't have sex, it's a lie to say nothing happened. This recalls when Viserys swore he would not replace Rhaenyra as his heir on the memory of her mother. As Rhaenyra lied while using this verbatim oath, do you think the writers are indicating that Viserys is also lying? Is this a hint that he will cave and replace Rhaenyra?
No. I think this is the opposite. This is actually like Viserys is going to take that vow very seriously, and she is using it as a tool to make people believe her. I don't think they're saying anything about Viserys's vow.
Yeah, I think kids do that sometimes, man. They'll take something you say as an adult and they keep that in their memory banks of like, oh, this is people say things when they want you to trust them. And, you know,
Sure.
Yeah, eventually that's part of them becoming independent adults. And the more you, I guess, make it sure that they know that the consequences of telling the truth will never be worse than trying to get away with a lie, then maybe it doesn't happen so often. But I don't know. We'll see. I'm in the middle of the teenage years. I'll let you know in 4 years how to do it right. Rick T says, I heard Joanna Robinson of The Ringer interview Hot D production designer Claire Richards, and I learned that many, if not all of us, thought were exotic tapestries in King's Landing depicting dragon on Targaryen sex are actually painting of sex acts for baby Aggie and anyone else to learn dragon riding, birds and bees. It's funny because this is something I listened to. I'm not sure. Because I was listening to this at 1.5x speed, but I thought she was like, I think you're supposed to still understand that they're tapestries. It's just they're not actual really woven tapestries. They're paintings.
Sure. Like the background in a lot of Star Wars isn't actual cities, right? It's
matte paintings.
Yeah.
But it could be maybe I misunderstood and they actually are paintings. I just because like the reason you hang tapestries on castle walls is not for decoration. We understand this, right? It's to dampen echo and keep like the cold damp radiating from the castle walls from being drafty and shitty. So like if they are paintings, then they're not probably doing a good job of either of those. But fuck, I don't know.
Maybe I misunderstood the tapestries. Are these pictures of human beings like 69ing and wheelbarrowing each other supposed to be dragon riding techniques? Did I misinterpret that?
I guess, yeah. That these
is that
are
how you what, ride a dragon?
The stuff that we thought were dragon on people sex or people on dragon sex are actually just people riding dragons.
Do I not understand what they mean by riding a dragon?
Well, you know, these are people that breed sister to brother. Who knows what definitions they have for riding. Turns out the maester's going to explain that riding can mean, you know, sitting on one's back or fucking the shit out of one. It's like that's another one of those dual use Targaryen words. Valyrian words?
There's still lots of Hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, the very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
And now, back to Hot D.
Audrey says, I had a different take about Masaria's motives with Damon than you expressed in your instant talk. I did not at all view her as a spurned lover turning on Damon, but as a businesswoman who's taking care to maintain the life she had built against all odds while still caring for someone who was once of great importance to her. This is a woman who is doing anything she can to live on her own terms, using every asset in her arsenal. As a foreign woman sold into sexual slavery, she was the lowest order in Westeros. After learning that even winning the affections of a dragon prince could not keep her safe from fear, she seems to take matters fully into her own hands. She's clearly become a trusted source of information to Otto, probably using a blend of Varys and Littlefinger's techniques by utilizing children and brothel workers alike to collect her information. Ooh, she's got that two-channel, that dual power she's built.
Really knows how to pick them from Damon to Otto to who now, right?
Yeah. Well, what's she going to do? Trust a Ned Stark type? They're just going to wind up the first to go.
Mm-hmm.
The way Damon used her as a pawn in his game to upset his brother definitely damaged their relationship to where he was not out of bounds for her to inform on him. However, she was not lying about protecting him. She got him safely off the streets and offered him comfort for his hangover. I think it was a legit cure because she could have so easily killed him or left him hurt countless other ways than bringing him to her home and waiting for him to wake up to poison him.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of I don't know. Like, this is a magical universe. So like a potion can mean anything from killing you with poison to making you infertile forever to binding you to her will. Like, you got to think less Walgreens and more witchery, you know? She was even tender in her placement of her shadow to shield his eyes from the sun, not moving until he proved he was going to be an utter dick about everything. Before she leaves. Before she leaves, she looks like she wants to tell him something more, but thinks better of it. Whether it was to express warning or speak of affection, I got the feeling she was a woman who could easily see Damon as still as immature as ever, and her life would be better at this point without him in it.
Yeah. I think you got the right of it. That's a very like nuanced look at what she's doing, and I feel like that's what they're trying to tell us in those scenes.
But she's still fucking him, right? Like,
I don't know.
Telling Otto that he was out with the princess isn't.
Not. You mean in the dragon?
Because that's the thing. Is like the kid still. There was still a changing of money. Like this kid and the white and Missaria are connected, right?
Uh huh. Totally.
So like she might be protecting his physical body, but
the king, like, who gives a shit, right? Like, he doesn't. Yeah, and she also like it, so
she might find her way to fucking him over politically, but she doesn't want to see him dead.
Sure.
You know, like, I could see that. Like, hey, he kind of did me dirty, and I would like to see you in disgrace, but I don't want to see you gutted in, you know, some back alley and flea bottom. Christina had another thought on Damon's level of planning this whole, because we asked, like, is this something that him and Corlys cooked up to, like, you know, put the hot seat under the Iron Throne? Maybe they should put the hot seat under Iron Throne, because then it could disinfect it.
Yeah.
Putting your daggers in the fire, more just getting your whole throne. Yeah, maybe once a month or so. You just heat it up till it's glowing red. Make sure all that shit's off there, and then you don't get boils no more. Christina says, I believe that Damon didn't know that Rhaenyra was going to be at King's Landing when he first decided to go over to bring Viserys to Crabfeeder's Hammer and to gloat, because she's supposed to be on her bachelorette tour for another 2 months. I got the feeling that the seeds were planted during their conversation with Rhaenyra by the Weirwood tree, because that was really the first he was hearing of her thoughts of being sold into political marriage. I feel like that planted the thought in his head of, hey, I could marry her instead. And at some point between then and leaving the clothes and the map for her in the evening is when he decided how he's going to do that, because he 100% took off her beanie so she'd be seen before they start hooking up at the brothel. Also, if you notice, there is a flash of Rhaenyra observing people on her own when they first enter the brothel before going to the back room, and then it flashes to Damon watching her from the distance while gripping a railing. You can almost see he's giving himself an eternal pep talk, like, all right, are we doing this, man? Yeah, you're doing this. And then he shoves off the rail and goes and grabs her and pulls her towards the back and pulls off her disguise. I think I agree with this analysis. I think that Damon is much more impetuous and rash than he is calculating. Maybe Corliss might have put something as a suggestion in, but like also, I don't think Damon would react very well to Corliss. Now that I've thought about it, like Corliss telling him like, hey, you know what you should do? You should go marry your niece. I really fuck with the king. I think that would be something that Damon would do the opposite of.
I don't know. I haven't got a good read on how manipulatable Damon is yet, because Corliss clearly succeeded in getting him to go fight the crab feeder with him. You know, to really.
But he also warned him, like, don't fuck with my family, you know?
Sure, sure. And I guess, like, if all of this is true and Damon did not come here to get with Rhaenyra, which I think I'm leaning toward after that explanation. Why did he come here? It's just to fuck with Viserys in another way, but what is that way?
I kind of think that Damon wanted to come in from the cold. He's like, you know
you
what?
So?
I've earned it. I'm going to, because like in the way he nuzzled
and
his brother,
like,
and
maybe
and,
I can be the heir again.
I don't know about that, but like if Maseria abandons him and he's like, you know, like, Rhaenyra kind of made it not fun camping here at Dragonstone. And what am I doing? I've won this war. You know, I've distinguished myself. I need to. I don't know. Because I think he does want. He still wants the throne. But I think he thinks that his way of getting there is by distinguishing himself and getting back in his brother's graces. And his impetuosity and his, you know, kind of take what I want philosophy fucks him over because he impetuously does this thing with Rhaenyra that enrages his brother instead. But I think that's why he came back. He genuinely wanted his brother back in his life.
Yeah. After. So does Viserys read what Daemon did as the same way that we read it as an audience? Like, he was sending the aid. Damon knew that he was sending the aid, and so he ended this war before the aid could get there so that Damon would look good and Viserys would still look weak.
Is
that how Viserys
so.
Is reading this? Or is Viserys just like, oh, well, he won the war right before we needed to send aid, so that's good.
I think you read it like he won the war before we sent the aid, and now he's coming back with a crown and a hammer, and this is scary. And then when he offers up both of those, it's like, oh, fuck yeah, we can be bros again.
Gotcha.
And also, Viserys is very drunk through most of this episode. Like, he's a happy drunk, but like
he's saying, drinking.
Oh no, he's saying more wine and the you know, I don't think he's like sloppy drunk, but
not
I
like
think,
he was last episode.
No, but in that garden scene where he's and his daughter and all that, no, I think he's
sure.
He's a little sloshed. I think he even actually literally sloshes his cup at one point. So they might be talking to Fed that he is also, because of his stress and the grief in his life, that he might just be kind of sliding into
his disease or whatever he's got. His
that
infection.
Ain't nothing either. Yeah. Like,
leaning on, probably driving him to drink,
leaning on Blackfyre as a cane. Like, they are showing this guy, and like a lot of people self-medicate, and that takes you to bad places,
especially in a world that doesn't have a lot of medication.
Milk of the poppy, baby. Why fuck around with the wine when he goes right to the medieval heroine?
Sure.
Bethany says, for the last episode, the hardest part for me is keeping my mind focused on how terrible a person Damon is, because Matt Smith does such a great job of making him attractive and heroic and compelling, just like how real life sexual predators are often charismatic and likable. It does seem that the show will treat a sexual predatory behavior as it is, as a black mark on Damon and a red flag for his character. It's intentionally characterization, and I agree with Jim on this one. They should have left it all on screen rather than have it explained as impotency in the bonus content. I did not get impotency from the scene. I think it works better if he changes his mind, or perhaps intended only to tease her. He doesn't really want her, not really. He wants her throne. I don't think she sees that, and it worries me. It's one of those ambiguous relationships that an older Rhaenyra would need to unpack with her therapist. She will one day realize he was just using her for his own purposes, I hope.
Mostly.
Yeah.
I'm starting to change my own mind on this, though. Like, if you look at it all the seeds that they've planted here, no pun intended, about Damon's impotency, I think it's starting to add up. It's pretty subtle.
Yeah.
So I might be changing my own mind on, you know, they haven't put it on the screen. I think they maybe have.
Yeah. The other thing important to understand is, like, when we're talking about sexual predators, I think it's useful to understand that I don't think they see themselves that way. Like, I don't think Damon is, like, in these scenes, like, fuck yeah, I'm using her to get to the throne. He also kind of wants to have sex with his niece, and he's interested in thrall. And, like, yeah, he's still capable. I'm not saying it's not bad. I'm not saying, like, I'm just saying that, like, we can't lose sight of how villains see themselves when we're trying to analyze their purposes and whatnot, because I don't think this guy's like a Littlefinger at all. And a lot of what we're talking about him, like, gives him a lot more agency than he probably even feels in his own life. Like, to me, he feels like a guy who's just lurching from one thing to another, trying to find love wherever he can get it, which can also be abusive and predatory for sure. But, like, there's a level of scheming that I think Bethany is applying to Damon that I don't think he possesses. But I could be wrong, so we'll have to keep watching. John says, Otto mentions to Alicent that Aegon is the king's firstborn male, ergo the rightful heir to the throne, but it's not true. The baby died earlier in the season that was the firstborn's, Balin. Maybe it's just semantics, but I was curious if that mattered, not in this universe. I got a couple of people ask this question. I thought it's pretty obvious that, like, I think it's improper to say he's the firstborn male.
Sure.
But it literally doesn't matter because you can't inherit shit when you're dead. And that's the only thing that the firstborn really matters. You know, like, that's all where the lands and titles flow through.
Should call him the eldest. That would clear it up.
Sewell says, okay, I think in regards to Sir Criston and Princess Rhaenyra's tryst, Maester Aeron needs to remind all the public of what comes of this if it's shed light. King Jaehaerys was so angry at his more outgoing daughter, Sarah, for participating in this sort of stuff that he banished her from the kingdom and gelded her partner and ran them through with steel. Yeah, in fact, I'm not sure if this is the same person, but the previous Lord Commander gelded one of his Kingsguard for violating his chastity. And just so we're clear, that's cutting Kristen off the person's balls.
Yep.
So when we, you know, I think that was one of the things missing from our analysis when we're talking about, oh, this is just, you know, he's definitely wants to fuck her, but he probably shouldn't. It's against his vows. And it's kind of like, well, maybe he'll be dismissed. No, you can get strung up, gibbeted, gelded, whatever the Lord Commander wants to do to you, whatever the king wants to do to you, whatever the princess wants to do to you.
Isn't that
you
true
know?
Of literally anyone at any time?
I guess so, but, like, there's things that are true. Like, you know, Joffrey could do whatever he wanted to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right up until he couldn't, you know? Right up until, like, his bullshittery arose to the point where people are poisoning him and trying to kill him, and, you know, like, it's... I think
there won't be consequences for it. I'm just
right.
Saying,
what I'm saying is, like, this is not just like anything a king can do in just a general sense of the word. This is like something a king or princess could do, and all the small folk would be like, yeah, that's about right. Oh, you fucked a princess and you're a king's guard? Yeah, you lost your balls. Yeah, we're not rising up over this outrage. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
Brent from San Diego says, wanted to chime in on all the feedback from folks who want to know how they can fix season 8 of Game of Thrones. Short answer is you can't. Long answer, they shouldn't. People who haven't gone through all the stages of grief since the series ended probably need to just stop watching the show. As a longtime reader of the books, before watching the show, I, of course, was saddened by the way the Double D's chose to end their fan fiction conclusion. There's a lot that could have been avoided in that clusterfuck, but it was in the end, it didn't happen. We have what we have. Barring a mistake decades in the future, we cannot retcon or change what has to come. I mean, come on, do people want the Game of Thrones Snyder cut? I've just had it with people asking what can be done when, in fact, nothing can be done.
Hard agree here. Strong agree.
But what about that steampunk Game of Thrones?
None of these have felt like adequate solutions or acceptable solutions even.
All right, would you like to hear Tony's suggestion?
Please change my mind.
I think I know how that House of Dragon and the Jon Snow project can fix at least one problem of season 8.
Invent time travel. Go back to season 6 and remake them for the first time.
One of the biggest issues I had with season 8 was the Azor Ahai prophecy meant nothing. Jon being Targaryen meant nothing. Jon is foreshadowed many times as the guy who would defeat the Night King, and to leave him out of the fight entirely was wrong. Here's how to fix it. Snow goes north for some reason. What he finds there is the court of the true king of the others.
Second winter. Oh,
the
shit.
The Night King we saw in Game of Thrones is the Daemon of the others. He amassed his own army to take over the land of the First Men and the Andals because he thought the true king wasn't moving fast enough. Perhaps they were both in line of succession, okay. And the true king is weak like Viserys, and his true chosen heir is the one who will bring the Long Night. This way, we still get the prophecy. In the books, the others have a language and mock the normal people, so it makes sense that they're more than just mute bad guys. This I think could work if you just say that, like, this was a minor incursion and the real threat is still to come.
Oh my god, we talk about minor and major fulfillments of prophecies. The Night King coming to Westeros was the minor fulfillment.
It is.
No, this is no better. The only way to fix this is time travel, and I don't see that happening.
Well, there you go. And because I like to shake things up, here is a very understated and low energy kickoff to the Maester's Corner. All right, Anthony, I'm bringing you in here hot. I don't have a prepared topic because dragons are on the listener's mind. Many questions about dragons and dragon lore. I urge caution because. The answers that you are looking for, all of you, are out there on the internet, and they are all massive spoilers for the House of the Dragon.
Yeah.
So, like, I get a lot of corrections when I kind of hedge and say, because, like, honestly, you're supposed to, in this mind, have a lot of these questions, and a lot of the questions we have on dragon lore are going to be answered on this show, you know, because we've previously dealt with essentially a teenager who accidentally hatched dragon eggs and was single mother figuring it out on her own.
That's right. Now
we have dragon lords under the tutelage of dragon trainers and dragon masters that they have these beasts saddled up and they're speaking High Valyrian to him. It's the difference between Luke Skywalker, you know, like George Lucas always said in Star Wars, you saw a crippled old man fighting a young farm boy. In the prequels, we're going to see Jedi, you know. We'll hope these prequels go a little bit better. But kicking us off, Tara here is saying, can any Valyrian bond with a dragon, or can only Targaryens do so? If the only Targaryens, then why weren't they the most powerful family in Valyria? I assumed several different families had dragons in Valyria. My thinking is, if there were 1,000+ dragons in old Valyria, and if Targaryens weren't the most powerful family, then dragons must have been more common, or the Targaryens would have ruled. I believe you said or implied only Targaryens can bond with the dragon, which made me rethink things. And more questions pop up, like, if any Valyrian has the potential to bond with the dragon, why doesn't Corlys have one? You may explain this with your comments on how hard it is to bond. I understand that we can explain Laenor's bonding because of his mother is a Targaryen, but does it actually matter? So I think the safest thing to say is that Targaryens firmly and honestly believe it matters. Does it actually matter is something that we're going to find out. Okay. Right.
Viserys says in this episode that the truth doesn't matter. It's the perception that matters. And that could be the case with a lot of things. Right.
So I want to quote from the Wiki of Ice and Fire, because these are all source statements, and notice the things that they say with certainty and notice the things that they say without certainty. It says dragons are intelligent creatures that can be trained to serve as battle mounts and understand vocal commands. They're said to be capricious in nature and had to be trained to keep from laying waste to everything around them. However, dragons will not allow just anyone to mount them. In Valyria, the noble-born dragon-riding families, the dragon lords, frequently married brother to sister to keep their bloodlines pure. It's generally believed that Valyrian heritage plays a part. I'm going to censor part of this paragraph because it's massive Dance of Dragons spoilers.
Right. Yeah.
Having Valyrian blood, no matter how directly, is not an absolute guarantee that bonding with a dragon will be successful. So they also say that once a dragon is bonded with a rider, that dragon will not allow anyone else to mount it alone while its rider lives, no matter how familiar said person might be to the dragon. But when the dragon bonds to but when the person bonded to the dragon is on the dragon's back, they may take along a passenger. When the rider of a dragon dies, that dragon can bond with a new rider. No rider has ever ridden a different dragon while their current dragon lived.
Mm.
However, when Prince Viserys Targaryen's dragon, Balerion, died, remember he swung his leg over the Black Dread, I think exactly once, and took it for a few wobbly passes around the Blackwater Bay. According to George Martin, Viserys did not take a second dragon, leaving the possibility that the rider might bond with a new dragon after his or her first dragon has died. Dragons who have had a rider once before are easier to bond with than wild dragons. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do we know? First of all, the Targaryens were not the only dragon lords of Valyria. In fact, they were a relatively minor house. Out of those thousand dragons that Viserys is talking about, the Targaryen family took 10 over with them. So they had 1/100th of the nuclear stockpile of old Valyria, give or take.
And you would imagine that there were lords in old Valyria who never tried, right?
Yeah.
It was just never the part of the, like, if you were a family that was wealthy because of your ship trade, why would you need dragons, right? You've got other people defending. It's a little bit like, I think it's like, in the Revolutionary War, if you are a really wealthy guy, did you need to have a general in your family? I mean, a lot of those families did want to have some war experience,
right?
But not every entrepreneur in early America decided, well, it looks like we're going to have to, you know, suit up, you know? Mm-hmm. So I would say that maybe the, like, Corlys Velaryon's ancestors were maybe wealthy because of trade. They didn't need to send their children into battle. That's my sense. That's my headcanon. Anyway.
That's exactly right. And I also think that the Dragon Lords seem to be there pretty protective. Like, they would be against the nuclear proliferation of their day. They wouldn't be handing out eggs willy-nilly. It would probably be a big step for a non-dragon riding family to start riding dragons. In fact, and you wonder if the Dragon Lords would even think that's possible. They don't have to be Targaryens, but the thing is now the Targaryens are the only last, they're the last surviving Dragon Lords, because all the other Dragon Lords died in old Valyria.
Right.
And like I said, Corlys is an interesting case because he's got children that are dragon riders, but they get that from their mother's side. The real question is, do you need the perception?
That's right.
Exactly. Or is this marketing material?
Yes, right. So it is advantageous for the Targaryens to keep this, if it is mythology, to keep it alive, right? Because it keeps everyone else from trying to ride the dragon. So, I mean, let's just imagine a scenario where someone else tried to ride a dragon and they died. Okay, well, how do we explain this? Do we explain it because, well, dragons are dragons and they might just dragon you up, you know?
Sure.
Or you could explain it like, well, maybe you shouldn't be trying. You're not Targaryen. Maybe you shouldn't try to ride a dragon. And as long as sort of those narratives take hold, I mean, how many small folk or other, you know, great houses are even going to try to do this?
Right. Right. And it's not like the Targaryens have open tryouts for just like, hey, have you ever wanted to think you could swing a leg over a dragon? You know, plus all the fact that the other thing is, it sounds like these dragons are all bespoke. Like, they won't take another rider as long as their rider lives. A rider won't take another dragon as long as a dragon lives. You got a limited inventory. Do you know how long it takes to get season passes to open up in, you know, a Green Bay? There's a lot of Green Bay people. A lot of people in Wisconsin would love to have Packers seats, but they got to wait a generation to get even a chance. Is that, you know, and can a New Yorker even sit in a Green Bay stadium seat? I don't know. You'd have to fight the legions of anyway. So it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, I think it's supposed to be an open question that may or not be answered in this show about whether anyone besides Targaryen blood can throw their leg over a dragon.
Let's say I was Viserys, or I wanted to protect the mythology. Let's say, you know, someone else was able to ride a dragon. I mean, from my point of view, I would say, well, they must have Valyrian blood somewhere in their lineage, right? Because I would want to keep the mythology going.
There's this concept of dragon seed they have, which are like, probably dragon, like Targaryen or Valyrian bastards. And that's exactly right. You'd have like, we talked about last week that you might have was this I can't get my fantasies. I can't remember if I talked about this in the Rings of Power or Hot D. But the idea that, you know, just like you might have a redhead, you might have all the way back to your parents are black hair, brown eyed people or brown hair, brown eyed people. And then suddenly a redhead, you know, and you're like, oh, my God, how did this happen? Was there some unfaithfulness here? And then you turns out great grandpa Seamus is in the family tree and he had flaming red hair. So like that's the same. It's like they're the Valerians are out there and they're having sex with a bunch of people. Who's to say?
Yes,
you get some baseborn get out of the whorehouses of Essos that didn't have a drop of that dragon seed in them. Mm-hmm. So it's I think you'll listen to some podcasts, you'll see some Reddit comments where people will confidently say one way or another. And, you know, I just think that like maybe they're a little bit more comfortable and essentially trafficking spoilers than me. Mm-hmm. Maybe they just haven't read all the sources. I've seen it wouldn't be the first nerd that confidently states an opinion that hasn't fully argued and justified it. But, I think we're just going to have to wait and see because there is things that hinge on the future story about whether that's true, obviously, because when you're fighting a war, you're going to start running out of dragons. And to the extent that humans are squishier than dragons, probably gonna start running out of dragon riders. So then what do you do?
Yeah, and I think it's probably worth saying, like, you know, there's a reason to bring fantasy into a story. Or there's a reason to bring magic into a story. Magic allows the author to explain things that he doesn't want to explain.
Right.
Right. So a lot of this goofiness is magic. I mean, there's no doubt that this is a magical connection between rider and dragon, and magic is fuzzy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Look no further than Melisandre, right? So
I want to hand the Maester's baton off to you by way of another email that was sent addressed to you, to the Maester himself. It's Andy. He says, Nymeria's story keeps coming up on the show. Last week, you mentioned during the Maester's Corner that Anthony has a background in Second Temple Judaism and the Dead Sea Scrolls, so I thought, hey, why not? Nymeria as a Moses-style deliverer. Mm-hmm. While people talk about Nymeria as a Xenia-type warrior, I've often viewed her as the Moses of the Rhoynar. Her people face slavery and death under the yoke of the Valerian, so she gathers her people. They flee across the sea for a new homeland. They have many wanderings on their way, but eventually arrived at Dorne, despite fighting and marrying the local Westerosi, even a millennium later, still maintained their Rhoynish customs. What say you, Maester Anthony? Does that map on well to your understanding?
Yeah, I think I'm going to...
The stepstones or the what was the thing that the Israelites wandered? The wilderness? The deserts?
I feel like in order to make this work, you're going to have to ignore some major elements in Moses' story. But Andy, what I could say is, in so much as we have sort of a liberating guide who takes a long journey and settles, you know, if you bring salvation to the liberator's people, and the fact that there are customs that sort of persist with the Dornish afterwards. Yeah, you could probably point to Moses. But here, let me give you a different idea on this. All right. So it doesn't map on perfectly. Moses is not a warrior. All right. So there you go. So you're going to need to bring in a few other characters. Like, for instance, like, what if we called Nymeria a hybrid between Moses and Cortez? Right. Because Nymeria burns the ships, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of a nod to Cortez. But then that doesn't quite work either because Cortez was a conqueror and, you know, depending on who you're talking to, he's a colonist. That doesn't quite map on either. All right, so let me throw another name at you maybe you haven't heard. Aaron, do you remember a few years back the HBO series The Watchmen?
Oh yeah.
Okay. And you all might have even covered that show.
We did.
People could look it up and listen to the show covered. There was a character on that show named Lady True. Do you remember her?
Lady True.
Yeah. She's sort of a Vietnamese superhero.
Oh yes. Right, okay, right.
Lady True.
Her father is a massive spoiler. Right.
So Lady True was named after a Vietnamese warrior from the 3rd century.
Oh, right.
All
right.
So let me tell you about Lady True. She's Vietnamese. She's from the 3rd century, and she helps her people against the invasion and oppression of Wu China. She is a warrior character. She rides an elephant into battle. Mm-hmm. And let me just give you a quote of something she says. She says, "I'd like to ride storms, kill orcas in the open sea, and drive out the aggressors, conquer the country, undo the ties of serfdom, and never bend my back to be the concubine of whatever man." All right, so this is interesting to me because that seems a little bit more in line with sort of the legend of Nymeria. And so, okay, so let's say, Andy, let's say that there is some Moses DNA there. I would say, yes, Moses, but in order to create Nymeria, you almost needed to combine Moses, Cortez, and Lady True to get that mythology. And we know that that Martin likes to create these kinds of hybrids.
It's true. Cross-cultural. What could you also, the first thing I thought of is like, could we just splash a little Joshua in there?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That would work too.
So but Moses died short of the promised land. Joshua was the general that kind of led the people to the promised land.
Right. And I think that the key here is just to note that, as with a lot of Martin characters, you'll find a historic or a legendary character to map some of his characters onto, but he always spices them up.
Yeah.
And honestly, this Lady True warrior figure sounds a lot more badass than Moses. Yeah. So do some research.
She's killing orcas in open sea. My God. My God.
Yeah, do some research on Vietnamese history, Andy. It'll be fun. It'll be fun.
All right, what do you have for us?
Okay,
research.
Yes, this this is going to be me kind of going a little. I don't dabble in fan theories very often, and it could be that there's people all over Reddit are already on this. I don't check, but let me just throw out a brief reminder about why weirwoods are not in the South.
All right.
So the weirwoods are originally thought to inhabit tree spirits, and they're worshipped by the children of the forest. And the Andals come along, the first men come along, and they adopt the religion, right? And they start doing what the children of the forest did. They would carve these trees, and the idea is the face in the tree would allow the tree spirit to check in on the human beings. All right, so whether that is true or mythology, when the Andals came along, they didn't like the idea of being spied on by these northern gods. And so what they did was they cut down all the trees in the South. Now, there are a couple notable exceptions. Like in the Riverlands, we've got a few exceptions. We can find a few weirwood groves in the South. But notably, there's no weirwood tree in King's Landing. Right. So
not on the show, of course. In the show, they are swerving on the canon and having a big old fat weirwood tree right there. But that mm-hmm. is a non-book canon detail.
Yes. And that makes me curious. Why do it? All right. So it makes me like, they have a lot of meetings outside. You know, they have a lot of important conversations by this weirwood tree.
It's true.
It makes me wonder, is there a reason why they made that choice? Is someone spying on these conversations? So, all right, I'll just press the pause button there because it might be a way off book. But here's what we learn in Martin's series with Bran's story. Bran goes up, he gets his Jedi training from the Three-Eyed Crow, and the Three-Eyed Crow teaches him that he can warg into birds.
Sure. And
he finds out that when he's in the bird, he feels an impression or an imprint of a previous warg. And the explanation given to him is, well, you know, some of these birds have an impression of their previous, I guess we could call them riders or possessors. And my thought was, that's an interesting idea. I wonder if that's the origin of these weirwood gods. You know, maybe a warg decided they were going to take a second life right before they died their human form. They projected their spirit into these trees, and that's where you get the idea of the weirwood gods. Now, that's my own headcanon. But here's one thing that we know for sure. You can spy on people, past and present. I don't know about the future, but you can spy on people past and present using this weirwood network. That's the whole reason it has a face on the trunk. Mm-hmm. Now, notably, in the book canon, there is a oak tree that looks a little bit like a weirwood tree, no face on the trunk.
Right.
So this show has decided they're going to give us two eyeballs on this tree. It makes me wonder, is someone spying on these Targaryens? And I'll leave it as a question.
Well, it's interesting because the showrunners have said throughout the season that they've intentionally framed and shot some things as if you are eavesdropping. And they're showing things like, you know, Jim and I are always talking about the trademark Daemon Targaryen lattice work. Spy chamber on the King's Council. Alicent had her latticework spy chamber in the King's bedroom. Right. Yeah. And there's a couple of shots where this episode, or like Sir Criston Cole and Rhaenyra are coupling, where it's filmed from that perspective as if there is someone unseen. And
it's
I wonder, voyeuristic, right? I wonder if there is some suggestion, because you're right. There is a lot of stuff happening in the Godswood. And we know that it's not like a live feed that if you miss it, it's gone, because Brandon got to see a lot of his dad's history before he was around by looking through the Weirwood network. If the whatever the Weirwood see, you if you're skilled enough, you can tap in and kind of like it's like a CCTV.
So I guess here's another way we could explain it. If we wanted to, if we were sort of a cynic to this theory, we could say, this is the showrunner's idea of getting these people outside, because otherwise these are just conversations in rooms most of the time.
Sure.
And we need some way to get people outside. There's got to be a beautiful garden for this castle, and let's put a weirwood tree here because it will help connect people to the previous show that they loved. Mm-hmm. That could be all that there is to it.
But that's boring and not fun.
That's boring and not fun. And I just wonder, there's a face on that tree. The whole reason that those eyeballs exist is to allow people to see through them and spy on people. And that makes me scratch my head. This was a deliberate choice that they're making to add this when they didn't have to.
And you wonder if this turns into a Targaryen anthology, they said, we move beyond the Dance of Dragons, that could be real handy. If you think of other pivotal points in Targaryen history, interesting stuff.
All right, so that's all I got. It's an idea. I would frame it as a question.
If they want more Meditations of a Maester this season, where do they find where do they find you, Anthony?
Yeah, search us out on Double Dragon. Most recently, we had a conversation with the linguist David Peterson. He helped us translate some of the dialogue. He didn't think that the subtitles were quite captured.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So you can come and hear that conversation with me and David Peterson over at Double Dragon.
All right. Thanks, Anthony. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, man.
All right. Again, thanks, Anthony, for coming on. The rest of the stuff is all dragons. It's all stuff about dragon lore. So let's get to it. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break. And now, back to hot D. Leslie says, I have a general question about the relationship between Targaryens and their dragons, and I wondered if there's anything in the lore that could provide insight. It's been mentioned several times that Viserys and his advisors see Daemon as a potential liability and have made efforts to keep him away from the Red Keep by arranging family, making him commander of the City Watch, and then finally banishing him at the end of episode 1. We see him fly away on Dragonstone on Caraxes. My question is, aren't the dragons a pretty significant weapon for the Targaryens, and doesn't one or more being away from King's Landing significantly weaken the Targaryen standing? Also, who do these dragons belong to? Do they belong to the crown, or does each dragon rider have their say over their own dragon? So much was made over Daemon stealing the egg, but there was no mention of the fact that he took Caraxes with him.
I understand the dragons are bonded to the riders, but you'd think the Targaryen rulers would want to make some effort to keep their biggest weapon out of the hands of those who might seek to do them harm. Jim, do you have any like gut feelings about how this plays out in the lore?
I mean, none that are informed at all.
Okay.
I'm also curious about it, though. It's a good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that, like, you got to... So keep in mind the... Because I talked about dragons in a Maester's Corner, and one of the things that they make clear is that a dragon is absolutely loyal to its rider, and the rider is absolutely loyal to their dragon, at least during the terms of their own life. It's a question about whether a dragon rider can take another dragon if their primary dragon dies. It's also not a question. It's a resolved question that a dragon will accept another dragon rider once their dragon rider dies. Okay. So that gives them a lot of power. You think about like in the old Roman days, the generals had a lot of power because all of the army belongs to Rome, but the men kind of follow and listen at primary allegiance to the general, you know, and that can be a problem. And I think that if you have a civil war, regardless of the dragon's loyalty and whatnot, and regardless of the dragon rider's loyalty, when you have a civil war, all bets are off. Like, there was a time in before 1860s where America was united and we had an American army, an American Navy, and American bases. And then there's a dispute about whether we should own people. And suddenly half of those American army and Navy and bases, you know, just went off in the night, you know. So, like, I think that's, you keep in mind that this upcoming Targaryen conflict is a true civil war. It's going to divide the realm. It's going to divide House Targaryen. So the question is, who's going to have the most dragons? Who's going to have the biggest, baddest dragons? And you can imagine the politicking that would go on and trying to secure those allegiances before or after the fact. And, you know, we are still in a stage setting for those battles to come. So...
Let me ask you this. So I can see this a couple ways, but what happened with the crab feeder and Daemon and his dragon? Is that a smart move by the showrunners to say, hey, dragons aren't the end all be all of weaponry in this world? A single dragon cannot obliterate an entire army, regardless.
Yeah.
Or is that a mistake saying? Because, you know, I mean, a single army or a single dragon rather took on all of King's Landing at the end of Game of Thrones. And I know people want to throw that out because it's the end of Game of Thrones, but we've seen it happen. I don't know how I feel about that. Them saying that like a dragon can't necessarily take an entire army and it won't just be dragons versus dragons. It could be, you know, ships versus dragons or ground troops with trebuchets versus dragons or in caves. I don't know. To me, that seemed too new to the dragons a little prematurely.
I mean, they definitely have the weak because, like, you know, again, in this time period, Dorne has still not been conquered because it's a rugged mountainous terrain where the armies can come and attack supply chains. And you hit and run, and then when they come after them, they just bleed into the mountains and go into their hidey holes in their caves, you know? And we see real-life examples. Like, you know, United States Air Force is not to be fucked with, nor are the next three largest air forces in the world, which are the U.S. Navy, we've got a lot of air power, but like in Afghanistan, that didn't count for a lot. In fact, I think we just got kicked out of that country. So those are very much, I mean, it's the thing is problem when you call them nukes. I think what they are is they're the air superiority in a day there is no other air superiority. So if you have a dragon, you got, you're just fucked on the ground. All you can do is take cover and do guerrilla wars, but that's not nothing. So, and when both sides have dragons, then it's an interesting situation there. Let's move on to Ashley, who says, while listening to your feedback episode for 103, you talked about Dany's dragon eggs potentially originating in the dance. However, in A Fire and Blood, George makes a point to mention that Alyssa Farman, a favorite of Rhaena dragon Targaryen, Jesus, who is the first daughter of Aenys the First, left
Aenys
to
the first.
Hell yeah.
There's a second Aenys?
There's so many Aenyses. And it's a long Targaryen's long line of anuses. Let it be said. Left to Essos with three stolen dragon eggs. They are sold to the Sea Lord of Braavos, and Jaehaerys threatened them with dragons if they hatched. We never find out what happens to them after this, and I believe it was George saying loudly, "These are Dany's eggs." Unfortunately, this happens in 54 AC, and we're currently around 106 AC, so we wouldn't get to see it. I don't think it's impossible that Hot D might put their own spin and change this, but this is where I always assume Dany's eggs came from. Let me suggest a Hot D spin. Laena Velaryon is being married to the Sea Lord of Braavos. Maybe those three eggs come back into the story somehow.
All right.
Might be interesting. I don't know. Jared says, "I am strictly a show watcher, and a thought crossed my mind during episode 3 ending battle scene with Daemon. Are the Targaryens able to control their dragons while in battle without actually riding them, or at least use them in battle? I felt like Daenerys in Game of Thrones only rode Drogon, and the other two were kind of each off on their own, but still were playing their part like she wanted. I wonder why Daemon didn't use the Red Worm in that final battle along with Sea Smoke just to make sure everything went to plan. So then they make me think that maybe they have to be riding them in battle to use them. Is there anything covered with this in the books? What are the rules of using a dragon in battle?" Boy, that's what's so cool about this, is that we're going to learn a lot of those answers to that question, to those questions. I would say that I don't think you can telepathically control a dragon. That was one of the big, like, what ifs with the whole Bran and Warging. Like, what if the three dragon riders are Dany, Jon, and Bran remote viewing the dragon, right?
Yeah.
And why doesn't Daemon use it? It's like, because I do think that the dragons are sensitive to their masters. I can't imagine a situation where Caraxes is just kind of like high above watching his master go through this gauntlet and he doesn't come out and ruin the surprise, right? Like, you wouldn't be able to control him. Just like this way Drogon, no matter how you lashed him down or tried to control him, would sit there and let Dany be. No, he's going to come there and fuck up anyone who's messing with his mom. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think that happens. But I do think that, like you mentioned, that Daenerys can have one dragon and she, like, and the other dragons are kind of like doing their part. Like, oh, there's Drogon breathing fire here, I'm gonna breathe fire, and we're fighting these guys, I'm gonna fight these guys, but like probably less control. But the other thing to remember is, like, Dany wasn't just a dragon rider, like she bonded to like all three of these dragons.
That's pretty unique.
And they saw her as her mother. So like they listened to her, like almost like a hatching dragon would listen to its sire dragon, although that's honestly canon, I'm just making up. I don't know that they have dragons have those type of relationships. So like it was a super special bond, I think, the what I got. But the other thing is, like, I'm saying that, but we just haven't seen enough dragons and bondings and stuff like that to kind of like have a good gauge. So yeah, and it's no fun to just
lot more dragon bondage in this show. Let me also throw this out there. We don't know how dragons communicate with each other. Also, I'm super interested to see if they have like a language, whether it's, you know, a physical one or a vocal one, because, you know, Drogon could just be communicating with the other two dragons while Dany's feeding him
right
orders and he's relaying that to the other dragons.
Right.
Who knows?
Right. Yeah. That's a good point, too, because we know that dragons can understand some Valyrian and accept simple commands like go to your hole and breathe fire and stuff like that. So they could be a lot smarter. I think it's going to do it. Hopefully that answers some of your dragon lore questions. We still had a lot more. A lot of people are curious about dragons, but a lot of my answers is just going to be, you're going to have to wait and see, because again, we're coming from an era where no one knew anything about dragons to an era where like many people know a lot of thing about dragons, and the 200 years, all that stuff got lost. So
it's kind of again, exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is exciting. And, you know, like the there's also a good chance that, you know, these accounts in the book are going to have multiple points of view, and there's going to be depends on how you look at it. So like, I just don't like, there are places out there that are giving definitive answers, but like at number one, I think a lot of those are spoilery, and number two, a lot of those are overly confident. So hotd@ballmove.com. Did we miss something? Do you want to have do you got a unique take that you don't think is represented? Do you got some opinions on the upcoming episode? hotd@ballmove.com is the place to send them in for this show. Thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate having you. Sunday night, of course, we'll be having our after show. It's live. It's exclusive for club members. We do release half of it for everyone to enjoy. That's the instant take. But if you want the full access and be able to ask some of your questions live through the YouTube chat interface, you want to be a supporter, support.baldmove.com. If you want to check that out, follow us along on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove. And again, finally, hotd@baldmove.com is how you send in feedback. Until Sunday night, I'm your host, Aaron.
And Jim.
See ya.